Man, you are seriously speaking my love language. Well, that's an intro quote if you have ever wanted one, Thorsten.
Hello out there, and welcome to this episode of the Sucks Podcast. And hello, Babo. How are you doing today?
Hey, Thorsten. I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, and so am I. Our guest today actually is Ákos Csertán from Budapest. He runs Atlas Rise, an impact innovation collective and company. And actually, Ákos and me met in Zurich this year, where he gave a really stunning talk about how to design for, how to say that, for the new age of capital domination, I would say. And actually, the moment I saw the talk, I knew I would love to have him here in our podcast. So hello, Ákos, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Thorsten. Hello, Babo. Thank you very much for inviting me here today.
So, we always start our podcast with something we call the Sucks Friendship Book. So we do this with all friends of Sucks. That's the goal, to learn a little bit more about you before we dive into the topic. And well, since it is still in the morning for us, how does a perfect day actually begin for you?
Okay, I'm not a morning person. I'm really not. And I start my mornings extremely boring by solving the New York Times puzzles. Yeah, something like that, but mostly sleeping in a little bit more, maybe sports.
Sounds perfect to me, honestly. But speaking about mornings, and I'm asking this because, well, I have this sometimes. How often do you wake up and feel, let's say, overwhelmed by all these problems we are facing in this world?
Actually, I think I'm in a constant state of crisis anxiety at the moment, at this point. In the middle of a perma crisis, in the middle of an economical crisis, in the middle of just getting out of the COVID crisis, I think everyone should be kind of anxious all the time.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah, it's one of those. I saw it written down recently, as in, I'm a bit done with exclusive once in a lifetime experiences, because I've had a few now. As a millennial, I've been going down the list, and my list is longer than it should be in once in a lifetime experiences.
Yeah, something like that.
Just as a kind of follow up, but also a different question. Do you feel working as a designer is solving that feeling or extrapolating that feeling and making it worse? Because you are in a position where you can make changes, yet you are not.
That's actually a really tough one, because for me, and I've had a lot of discussions about this with both creative coaches and designers and other designers. I rather have the feeling that working as a designer kind of makes it worse, because basically you are always exposed to the worst of the world, at least in the sense of, you're working with people's problems, the world's problems. You're always being immersed in problems, and that's what you have to keep thinking about. And basically, what I was just talking about with a psychologist friend, is that basically you have two choices as a designer. Either you do extremely boring stuff and make sure that you are not really immersed in the problems that you are solving, and you will end up a really happy but extremely bad designer. Or you actually let yourself take the risk, be immersed in those problems that you are facing, that you are trying to solve. And then what happens to you is that if you don't have extremely great coping mechanisms, then you're going to burn out extremely fast, because us as designers are not taught how to, separate the parts of our personalities that are working with the problems, protecting the rest of our personalities. It's like a major issue, I think, in the design world right now, mental
Yeah,
health.
I agree. Yeah, Thorsten also gave a talk about it a few years ago, on Adobe Max, I think, as well. But actually, now that we're on the subject, let's segue a bit into how did you get into UX design and design in general?
So I came from psychology. So
yeah,
originally, I'm a psychologist. Specifically, I learned research methodologies and social psychology. And then basically I started working with what we back then called software ergonomics, because, mm-hmm. you know, 20 years ago, there was no such thing as UX as it is right now. So I worked a lot with usability engineering and lab testing of software and basically the hardcore HCI part of user experience. And I stuck with it for quite a while. So I was working in UX mostly at agencies and startups and product companies for the better part of the past 16, 17 years. And I shifted more and more to service design and strategic design.
And I know you also run the biggest UX meetup in Budapest, as far as I know.
I'm one of the people who run it. There is a lot of people behind that also. So yes, I think it's been for like 7 or 8 years since I've been one of the organizers of UX Budapest. Which is, yes, I think it's the biggest technology-related meetup group in Central Europe. We have like 4,000 members. Actually, we are just going to have a meetup today because we have a meetup every month. Now we are up to like 2 meetups per month almost.
Wow.
And it's usually like 100, 150 people.
Nice. Maybe I would like to catch up on what you said before in terms of we as designers at some point have to protect ourselves and find strategies, right, in how we take care of ourselves. And that's a question from our friendship book fits pretty well here. So one of the strategies could be separating yourself from your work. And well, our work mostly happens on the desk in front of the computer. And so what's maybe your favorite place away from the computer or even away from any technology?
Mm-hmm. So actually, I do a lot of things. One of those things is that for the past 6 years, with a couple of colleagues, we've been organizing designer camps. Basically, we are taking about 20, 30 designers to some kind of remote rural location. Working on local problems, and we're using that as kind of a digital detox for designers, because basically it's mostly for UX designers who spend most of their time in front of screens, but for those 3 or 4 days they are not allowed to use anything that basically uses electricity. So only pen, paper, proper research, interviews, working on boards, and that's one of my happy places. Also for digital detox. And my other thing is I play tabletop RPGs.
Ah, oh, nice.
Not Dungeons and Dragons anymore. Currently, we are mostly playing Cyberpunk. Mm-hmm. That is actually a really transformative thing, I think, for me to move away from technology, because you're immersing in something that is kind of extremely technological in the sense with cyberpunk, but you are doing it in an absolutely non-digital way, and that's a really cool experience.
Oh, nice. And do you go to live role-playing events as well?
Unfortunately not. I would really love to. Unfortunately, there is no good community here for that.
Now, speaking of pastimes that we do you have a favorite book and or movie?
I think so, yeah. So I think my favorite book, or at least the book that I read a lot, like, I don't know, at least every year, is The Passion by Janet Winterson. I don't know if you know her, her work. She's basically kind of usually described as a feminist writer, a feminist novelist. And she's writing a lot in magical realism, and her work is I think extremely interesting, extremely immersive, specifically because of her language. And there is one that I always tell designers to read at least once in their lives as an adult, because it's a children's book. And Thorsten, at least you definitely know it. It's Mumu by Michael Ende. That's what I'm indoctrinating designers with, because I believe that Mumu is the perfect example of the designer. with movies, it's harder because I like a lot of movies. I'm usually torn between A Night on Earth and Straight Story by Lynch.
Nice. That's so cool that you named Mumu, because, well, we spoke about that, right? And I use that a lot in my talks as well, and always tell people, please read this book or listen to it as an audiobook, whatever. But you have to
absolutely
get into
and you
book.
Have to read it as an adult.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because that's how you actually understand it.
It's so hard to believe, I think, right, that this book was written in the 70s. Yes,
I think
in the 70s, and that you read it and you feel like, no, that must have been written a few years ago, because it's fitting so perfectly to this day.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, and to the work of designers, it's fitting extremely well.
Yeah. So people out there, please, if you haven't read.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Since we are the Sustainable UX Network and speak about sustainability, we would like to ask, what actually is sustainability for you personally?
And that's like so hard to find a good personal definition for, because obviously there is a lot of definitions for that. For me, what I'm trying to go for when I think about designing for sustainability is designing for long-term balance. Mm. Long-term balance of the ecosystem, which is not about growth, but it's about growth in the sense of living better together, all of the actors of the ecosystem, including humans and non-humans.
That's why I so much wanted to have you on the podcast, because you're speaking deep from my heart there. Definitely.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. As you said, there's a lot of different definitions of what sustainability is. Most people just have their own. We try to work a lot with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, the 17. We always like to ask this. Obviously, we realize all of them are important and all of them deserve the right attention. But for you personally, which one sparks like the most passion?
And that's an easy one for me, because that's the gender equality part, because I really believe that on a global scale, that's the goal that has the most direct and indirect effect of how we are operating as societies. Access to knowledge, especially, is what I'm very passionate about, as in access to education, access to any kind of knowledge for all genders in all societies, because that has like an extremely strong ripple effect that goes through societies and supporting other economical and sustainable goals.
Man, you are seriously speaking my love language. I 100% agree with you. This is like gender equality is by far the one I feel most passionate about as well. Now, we try to do as good as we can for sustainability, but we are all still human, so we are flawed by nature. Do you have any guilty pleasures in terms of sustainability where you know what you're doing is not perfect, but we're human.
Yeah, cheese and avocados. So I know that it is like technically possible to live a life without cheese and avocados. I just don't believe that that's a life worth living. Mm-hmm. So I know these are unsustainable products. Cheese is the only reason I'm not vegan. And avocados, because those are also not vegan.
They're not?
Well, in a sense, like proper vegans don't eat avocados because they include the production of avocados includes animal cruelty towards the bees that are transported a lot between avocado farms. So actually, avocados are really not okay.
Right. I thought it was, so I on a sustainability thing, I know that avocados are just logistically
they are a nightmare.
A nightmare. And the same with like the amount of land and the amount of years it takes for a tree to grow into and how much, you know, there's many reasons. But the bees I didn't know about. So that makes them not even vegan. That's very interesting.
I didn't know that either. For me, avocados was always because of the water. Huge amount of water.
Horrible product.
So, man, we need to stop talking about avocados. But it's so good though.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You are now officially a Sucks Friend certified because you have filled in our little friendship book.
Can I get a little diploma of that?
We will send that in the mail. It will be with you post haste.
Thank you very much.
So yeah, let's jump into your work. And as I've already said, we met in Zurich at the Interaction Conference, and your talk was definitely one of my highlights. And Bavos told me before, hey, you were saying that sometimes, but well, there have been a few highlights, and you have been definitely top two, top three, whatever.
You're too kind, Thorsten.
No, because what I really liked is that you have these, I loved your philosophical approach to look onto these things. And honestly, at some points I had to really concentrate to follow your talk because it was so deep and there was so much stuff in it. And that's what I loved actually so much. And I loved how you brought together the human-centered design and the end of the Anthropocene. Right, so that was the age where humans actually shaped the world, and these ages is ending, and that was mind blowing for me when you were talking about all these things. So maybe let's do a full kickstart here and jump directly into the problem space. And what would you say? What is wrong with human centered design?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of things, and. Obviously, a lot of things are great about human-centered design. So I'm definitely not saying that we should abandon humans and our entire design history or anything like that. My primary issue started with the realization that there is an extreme over-promise and under-delivery in human-centric approaches of design. And what I mean by that is that, obviously not openly, but implicitly, we have the understanding that human-centered design and the human-centric approach is going to be able to solve the big issues in the world. It is a good way of solving wicked problems. And obviously, the wicked problems are not solved at the moment. They are getting worse. I believe that the reason behind that is a couple of assumptions that are embedded in our design practices, which are coming from our anthropocentric understanding of the world, which obviously influences our culture. It influences the way we are thinking about products, the way we are thinking about design practices, that comes from the understanding that meaning is only for humans, agency is only for humans. Mm-hmm. The understanding of the world is basically the understanding of the world of humans. And the world is what we see from the world. And that's basically the problem space of where we are designing. And I just don't think that some of these anthropocentric assumptions are actually true and they are actually working. And true is obviously a strong word. Obviously, no assumptions, no philosophical assumptions are actually true. I just also believe that these assumptions are not practical in the sense of how we are solving wicked problems in the world. Because if we are doing that in a human-centric way, then we are basically limiting our understanding of the world and engineering our design practices to limit our understanding of the world and our influence to what is going on with humans. And there is a lot more going on in the world outside of humans. There are post-human things and human-created hyper-objects that are happening in the world, and we have to tackle that somehow.
Do you have an example of a human-created hyper-object?
Yeah, capital. But also corporations are, in a sense, I wouldn't say that that one specific corporation can be specifically by definition described as a hyper object, but basically I think like a corporation, a large corporation in itself, is a post-human object that has its own agency. The decisions, the operation, the motivations of a corporation cannot be described anymore as the sum of all of the humans that are within that corporation.
I agree.
It has its own will, in a sense, that is already detached from all of the human goals that were behind it. But also, ideas can be hyper objects in our world that that have their own agency. An example that is used a lot for this is actually populism. So populism is such a complicated issue, such a complicated construct in the world that we have created, that at this point it cannot be reduced to all of the agencies of all of the people that are involved in operating a populist system. It is a system, it is an agent on its own. Or climate change, that's also a hyper object. You can't really describe it, you can't really connect to it, even in a cognitive level. Only little parts of it or symptoms of it you can connect to.
Okay, so there's a few terms that you used in your explanation that I quickly want to dive a bit deeper into. One of them is Anthropocene versus Capitalocene. Could you, for us, just quickly explain the difference between the two and how we've shifted from one to the other, maybe?
Yeah, I already, I think I even said that in our, in my talk in Zurich, that I have an issue with the term Capitalocene, because I used it because I wasn't really able to find a better one, and I'm still working on that, and I still can't find a better word for describing. I think it's just too narrow.
Yeah.
But basically what we mean by Anthropocene is the epoch of the world where humans are the primary actors. Human activity is what's shaping the world, shaping the ecosystem, shaping nature, actually.
So what we've been doing for thousands of years at this point.
Yeah, there's a lot of temporal definitions of Anthropocene. Some believe, actually, I like that that broader approach to it, which dates the start of Anthropocene to the start of farming.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Approximately like 8,000-10,000 years ago, where urban communities started to form, because I like that definition, because that's when we actually started engineering nature. That's when we actually started inventing new species. And like started to have a major effect on the ecosystems. So I think that humans started becoming less of the primary actors in the world, giving over that place to, well, this kind of post-human hyper-objects like capital, for example. Well, at least in the mid-50s, 60s, in the is it called, I think, the Great Acceleration, when basically we started building atomic bombs and extremely fast technological advancements and everything like that. Probably we started that shift earlier than that, like in the 18th century, the entire Industrial Revolution that already started to change how we humans are interacting with the large things that we are creating. And basically, I really do believe that that at the moment, these post-human things that we have created actually are the ones that have the highest influence on the world and on the ecosystems that we are existing.
Actually, I remember from your talk, and I've written that down because I found that really, really to the point, where you stayed out in your talk, what's the difference between between the Anthropocene and the post-Anthropocene. And you say in the Anthropocene, okay, everything is human, right? Agents are human, humans are human, ethics are human. And then you say, okay, in the post-Anthropocene, it's like, well, agents are non-human, as you elaborated before. Humans are extinct, and well, and ethics are post-human. Well, and that sounds, I agree. Still, it sounds really drastic, I would say, right? And so my question would be, if we are already in this epoch, and if, for example, capital is shaping the world instead of humans, how much power do we as designers actually still have?
I think major, actually. That is mostly because design has been having more and more influence in the world in the past couple of decades. So we are sitting at higher and higher tables at the moment. So it all started with product designers being involved in everything and architects being involved in everything. Now we are involved in business design, service design, strategic design, all kinds of actually really influential design practices if done right. And actually we have another superpower, I think, as designers, is that at these higher tables, in these business discussions, designers are usually the only people that have a license to be weird. So as a designer, you are not going to be fired for asking extremely weird questions. You're not going to be fired for questioning the entire business model of a large corporation. You are hired to do that. It's okay for you to go into strange discussions about how to change maybe even fundamental things. And obviously it's hard. Obviously, you're not going to get there at first. Obviously, it's an uphill battle, of course. Mm-hmm. But at least, unlike other people, we are allowed to do that. And obviously, everything is designed by designers. So, you know, it always starts with the designer. Change always starts with the designer. Mm-hmm. In the broad sense of the designer, obviously.
Yeah.
And I totally agree. I see this is the question that very often comes from the community, I think, and I guess maybe do you get this question a lot as well? Because I get exactly these questions all the time.
Absolutely. Yes, I do get this a lot. But at the same time, I'm a big advocate of designer optimism.
Yes.
So as a designer, it's optimism is not about your personality, whether you are an optimist or not. Optimism is a method of working, basically that you are, as a designer, operating in a mind space where you kind of force yourself to believe that there are positive sum solutions for problems. That doesn't mean that you always need to design stuff, whatever, but it does mean that you need to keep believing that problems are solvable, because if not, that really hinders your creativity.
Well said.
No, that's a really good tip for everyone out there.
I've written down another quote from your talk, actually, and I think it fits pretty well here in terms of our responsibility as designers, because you said, or you asked this question, does what we create justify what we destroy?
Yeah, that's from Tony Fry. That's from Tony Fry's book. But I just love that quote, because responsibility of the designer is something that I've spent a lot of time with. So doing talks about that and lectures and stuff like that. And there's obviously a lot of ways to understanding the responsibility of the designer and who we are actually responsible towards. And I like the understanding of designerly responsibility as, yeah, we can say quantifying or even just looking at what we are destroying when we are designing stuff. Because design, basically, at least in the current sense of it, and it doesn't have to be, but in the current sense of it, it's destroying always something. It's an apocalyptic thing in a sense. Basically, not just resources when you are building a product, but also, for example, if you're looking at it from a humanistic point of view, when you are designing a product, you keep destroying time. So I actually had a TEDx talk about that that I still haven't translated to English, but I will. It's actually in the works, where actually I used Momo and the Thieves of Time Bank to describe that basically when we are designing anything, especially digital products, what we are doing is we are destroying people's time and replacing it with an experience. What happens is that people are trusting us with their mm-hmm. time, and we have to make something good out of that, because that time actually will not exist anymore. They will not be able to use that for anything else that's destroyed. And the same goes for an ecosystemic thinking, or like an economical or ecological thinking. When we are creating something, we are destroying some kind of natural resource. And when our product is used, some kind of natural resource is destroyed forever, and that cannot be used for anything else again. So as we are in this podcast, all of the electrons that are being used for operating the systems that we are using, those are destroyed forever. So we have to make sure that this podcast actually creates more value than all of the natural resources that we are destroying when we are creating it, because it's always a trade-off. It's always something that we are destroying when we are creating. And when we are thinking about responsibility, I really like to think about that, as the question is not always how we should be designing. It's not always what we should be designing. It's also whether in a specific situation, do we even need to design something? Is adding something to the world a good idea at a specific moment? You know, in general, as designers, like traditionally, we are usually techno-optimists in a very broad sense.
Yeah.
That when we see a problem, we add stuff. We add technology. Technology can be agriculture. Technology can be
medical,
mobile phones, whatever. And basically, we are really stuck with this entire additive nature of techno-optimism. Even when we are creating problems for ourselves, we are adding more stuff to solve it. But that's like an extremely product-centric thinking about the world and the product-centric thinking about design. I think you can actually think more ecosystem centric, and think about how you can intervene in an ecosystem, and not think about what can you add, but think about how can you make it better. And that's I think a very different thinking about your responsibility as a designer.
Totally agree. And I think you said, as we had it before, this Momo metaphor is so perfect, and I really like using that as well. These times thieves, or in German, it's the great gentlemen that are these time.
Yeah, the great gentlemen.
Time thieves. And it's what I found really interesting is that even for our users, we are doing bad, right? So the one people we always put to the forefront and say, okay, we do all the best for our users, even them are harmed by what we do when we do these things.
If we are not doing our job right, if we do not have some kind of understanding of our responsibility, because I think the big issue is not that we don't have a very specific vocabulary for the ethics of design, because obviously different people should be having different ethical norms for design. And that is perfectly fine. I think the issue is that most designers are not thinking about it. Most designers don't spend time in defining their own approach of what is ethical, what is okay, what is my understanding as a human being, because I think that harm a lot of time comes from different understanding of what we mean by a human, as in how inclusive we are. What is the thing that we are actually considering our user, which is a human being, and what are the things that we are not considering a human in our way of working?
Yeah. So what I hear is that as designers, we are going to have to change, or at least become more aware. And actually, if I look at your website, there is an opener right there involving change, which is change or die trying. We love it. We opened the website and the first thing we said is like, this is an amazing intro. But now that I hear you speak, I'm wondering, how hard do we have to try changing? Where do we reach the point that we can no longer compromise in the given world and something has to budge or break? Are we going to reach that point?
Unfortunately, I'm kind of afraid that we are. But let's be optimistic.
Yes.
So what I mean by change or die trying is specifically for any kind of business, any kind of thing that is operating in the world. At the moment, either you change the way you are operating businesses, you are delivering services, you are creating products, or you're going to die anyway, because either we are going to end up in a hardcore apocalypse, or you are going to become irrelevant in the future that is about to come. I strongly believe that business in general has to change how services are delivered, how products are delivered, how the needs of customers are even catered for, because I just don't believe that that this constant growth in the sense of economical growth is going to be working. I really don't think that unlimited growth is actually a thing. I think that if we don't rethink how we are understanding our capitalist norms, if we don't change that, at some point we are as a society going to get to a point where it may have a big collapse. But about compromise, I think compromise is hard in design for me, because I don't think that designers in general should be thinking in compromises. Because, yeah, of course, we say a lot that it's about balancing different kind of needs and everything. But for me, compromise always means a zero-sum game. Somebody loses, somebody wins. You win a little, I lose a little. Basically, we are trying to find the balance by creating something that is actually not ideal for anyone. We are giving a little bit to the business on the expense of the user. We are giving something to the technology on the expense of the planet, something like that. And I think designers, at least mentally, should be thinking about positive sum outcomes, in the sense that at least we should try to always, instead of compromising, go for new creative ways of solving issues in a way that that generates value for all of the stakeholders, and all of the stakeholders, including not just, you know, business and customers and everything, but also like nature, also like all of the important non-human stakeholders around that. And obviously, you can't always do that. Sometimes you have to compromise, but I think thinking in compromise is not a good mindset. Thinking in positive sum is a better mindset. Of course, it burns you out faster.
And I think I totally agree on this, and I see it exactly the same way. Still, I have the feeling that in the daily work of many designers, too often they have to work in compromises, right? Compromises in terms of, okay, there is, well, what is the best for the user? What is the best for the ecosystem around? But then there is, what is the best for the product, for the business model? And I think that's the sort of compromise we very often find ourselves in. And I wanted to quote something I heard. I have been at the conference last week, and I saw Monica Bilskiter, and she's a future designer, great person. I can highly recommend to look to her talks. And she had this nice saying, and she said, okay, everyone's utopia is also someone else's dystopia, right? And I think that is something we as designers hopefully get better in seeing this, how these things belong together. Still, I'm afraid that business, the evil business side, only wants to see the utopia, only speaks about the utopia, right? And that we find ourselves in a situation where we should we try to find a compromise between the greater good and the business goals? Or when do we reach a point where this, as you said, that where we shouldn't think about this compromise anymore, where we maybe need to go into, and you said, into designing new ways. I would say maybe we will reach a point where we need to go into confrontation with someone. And how could that look? And I don't have an answer about this. I'm thinking about this a lot, right? And trying to find answers on that, because I'm very much usually about, okay, how can we bring align people with us on this way into a better future? Because I think that's an important way of doing it. But at some points, we might not be able to align people to by compromises, by explaining things. At some points, we might to go into confrontation. When do we reach this point, and what, how can we do this? And as I said, I have no answer as well. I'm really curious if you have an idea.
I don't have a proper, like, good answer for that either. The first idea that I had when you were talking is that, I mean, nobody said it's going to be easy to be a designer. And it's not. At least if you are actually committed to your work, then it's not an easy job. But the other thing is that when dealing with business, I think it's not really about confrontation. It's not really about the compromise. It's a little bit about trying to at least assume that you are able to come up with solutions that are, for example, sustainable, that are, for example, generating some kind of positive outcome for the world. That actually makes sense from a business perspective, because obviously no business can be expected to make a product that is not going to generate better profits than the previous version. So if you are actually trying to sell things like sustainability and caring about the world and these kind of things for companies, you have to think with the head of capital, with the head of profit, and make sure that while you are generating some kind of positive outcome for the world, you're also generating something that is profitable. A good example for that is, obviously there are a lot of opinions about electric mobility. let's not even go into that and assume that everyone is right and electric cars are actually better than internal combustion engines. Basically, that's not the reason we have a lot of electric cars on the roads right now. It's not because they are sustainable.
It's because they're profitable.
It's because they are extremely profitable.
And they're subsidized. They're massively subsidized, right? That's why people...
Well, yes, but at the same time, at the moment, there is a trend in the automotive industry switching over to electric cars, because in a couple of years, with the current technological trajectories, the profit margin of electric cars is going to be much higher than internal combustion engine cars. That's the reason they are switching. And these are the kind of things that I think needs to be understood, that if we want a business model to shift, we have to make sure that the new business model is more profitable than the previous one. You know, it's like the same with sustainable products and people. So people cannot be expected to buy sustainable products because they are sustainable and sacrifice utility. Like, your sustainable toothbrush has to be at least as good as the non-sustainable toothbrush.
Mm-hmm.
Your sustainable website has to be at least as good as the non-sustainable website, because people are not really going to make decisions based on that.
But
people are going to go for utility and these kind of things.
But the question is, what is good? Because so what came into my mind is, like, I mean, in our world, we have a very simple way of how we measure value, right? It's like profit and growth. And
yes.
And I'm not saying we should totally get rid of it, but we could talk about, well, do we have to add new additional categories of value? And then like, you can question what is good. If we measure it with the old, only with the old categories, yes, then it's easy. But maybe we have to introduce new categories and explain them to the people out there and explain them why maybe this is also a good way to look at something and to measure its value. And how can we get into this direction?
It's actually a really hard one, because the definition of good is also something that I'm thinking about a lot, because I've been in a lot of discussions about behavioral design, and that's where it usually comes up, in the sense that obviously you can achieve anything with behavioral design. With the proper type of behavioral design, I can make you recycle, but I can also make you, with the same type of techniques, generate much more plastic waste. Whatever I decide is the right behavior, I can build it. And it's, I think it's a really interesting question. If companies or corporations or even governments are entitled to make any kind of decision about what is considered good, what are the behaviors that are considered good, can a soda company decide whether recycling is a good idea or not? Who should decide about these kind of things? Because it's not that extremely clear that recycling is a good idea. Because obviously, yes, it's better than not recycling, but at the same time, it creates a couple of even bigger cobra effects and additional problems in the world that were not there before recycling, and it's shifting the society in a very unfavorable way. And these kind of discussions really, really philosophical, because they are going into the direction of, I don't know if you know the term libertarian paternalism.
No.
Basically, it's an understanding of the world that usually behavioral design people are using, which means that it is perfectly fine to paternalize people and decide for them, even in a profit-oriented way, on what are the acceptable behaviors in the world, and it's okay to intervene in behaviors in a way to build for the better, and capital is the one that should be in charge of maybe making those decisions. And I have some issues with that, because obviously we are using extremely powerful tools as designers, and especially service designers and user experience designers and digital people that are able to fundamentally change the world, fundamentally change the world of humans at least, and have extremely far-reaching effects in our societies. And yeah, for me, it's like really hard to define how you are even able to define good, or even if you are, I don't know, entitled to ever do that. Mm-hmm. So I have issues with how to answer this question. Obviously, I think that more and more companies are understanding actually that new type of KPIs, new type of metrics are inevitable for their operation.
In fact, yeah, that's a really interesting point to talk about KPIs. And I think the natural follow-up question is how can we pressure these companies to adopt these new KPIs? Is there something we can do as designers to help here?
I mean, as designers, one workshop at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, this is where I think this posthumanistic approach and posthumanistic understanding of corporations actually helps, because in a sense, corporations, we usually say that corporations are evil. They're not evil. They are just operating with a non-human logic.
Mm-hmm.
They're rather weird and strange and alien, and not that much evil. But at the same time, the people that we are interacting with as designers, people working at corporations, they are humans. And they are usually decent, great human beings who are also under pressure from all of the crises that we are facing. They are also influenced by, I don't know, climate change, economical crisis,
yeah,
all these kind of things. So basically, it is possible to work together with the people and influence the people, and the sum of all these people is at some point going to be influencing how a corporation is actually operating.
Yeah.
So basically, I think as a designer, you can engineer the people in the corporation that are going to have an effect on, mm-hmm, on the corporation at large.
Yeah, there's one word in your talk that immediately put a smile on my face. Whenever it's used, I'm always excited about what's going to come. It's cyborgs. You used the term cyborgs. Since we live in a cyborg relationship with our technology, could you elaborate on this? Why are we cyborgs? How do you define this?
Actually, currently, that's what I can elaborate the most on, because actually with a colleague and friend, Norbert Krijan, Thorsten, you may have met him on IXD, because he was also a speaker there. We are actually working on something that we are calling Cyborg-Centric Design Framework, and we are using...
I already love it.
We will actually do one of the prototype workshops of that at Push UX in a couple of weeks. And basically, the idea behind that is that from a cognitive and psychological perspective, we should probably start understanding people as cyborgs. Yeah, this is a cliche. We are more and more interconnected with all of the technologies that we are using. But at the moment, all of the technologies that we are using are so integrated in our entire cognitive operation. They are so influential in defining our reference of the world, our understanding of the world, our interactions with the world, that basically is just not even really possible to find the line where the human ends and the machine starts.
Yeah.
So basically, we are kind of these biological, technological ecosystems in ourselves that have obviously a biological human part, but it also has some technological part. And what makes it even more, for me, a little bit scary, but also really interesting, is that a lot of those technologies that are at the moment embedded in our brains, in a sense, are extremely complicated technologies that have their own agency. Some of them are AI powered, some of them are actually like huge technological companies, like that have their own will, that have their own thinking, in a sense, that are actually making even that interaction point between this cyborg type of thing and the world hard to pinpoint where that connection is. So basically, in our current world, we can actually describe people as like an ecosystem that doesn't even really have proper borders anymore. And just connecting with other ecosystems outside in the world. So that's the sense I'm usually using the word cyborgs.
Sounds really interesting. And I would love to actually, I will be at PUSH, but I will not be at your workshop, unfortunately. Would love to hear more about that. We have to continue this conversation.
We will just invite you back to do an entire episode about cyborg-centric design framework.
That's good. Like, do the test and then come back with your findings, and we'd be more than interested to deep dive into this. I do want to move on in a sense. Like, in your talk, you end on three principles that you've created, how we as a designer can navigate the post-Anthropocene world. Could you introduce us to them and quickly elaborate on each?
Mm-hmm. But I'm not yet perfectly comfortable with all of them, because they are everything I'm trying to explain in this entire post-anthropocentric thing is absolutely work in progress. So yep. I'm still testing a lot of ways of operating. But basically, what I was also talking about there is first start from the outcome and not from the experience. Meaning that that basically we have, like, as designers, specifically interaction designers, we have a fetish for creating the experience. We really believe that we say things like we are not designing the product, we are designing the experience that is created by the product for the user. And actually, I kind of think that's just not enough. It's just not good enough to think about the experience that we are creating. What we should be thinking about primarily is what is going to happen if we are creating a specific product, a specific change in a product, including the experience, including the long-term effects on the human of that specific experience, including the long-term effect of that product in humanity, in the world, and in the entire ecosystem. The experience is just not good enough anymore. And it's hard, obviously. We don't have the tooling for that, but we should probably start working on the right design tools and the right design methodologies for thinking more in outcomes. Like, speculative design is good at it, but speculative design is obviously not something that we can do in our everyday practice all the time. But for example, it would be like a really great idea to to start infusing our everyday practices with some kind of speculative practices.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking cyborg centric, yeah, basically that I just thought,
yeah.
but basically, yes, let's let go of the idea that humans actually exist in their pure biological forms. They don't. Mm-hmm. And designing interventions and not artifacts, basically what I'm trying to challenge is the entire additive nature and additive understanding of design, which is that we usually define ourselves as designers as creative individuals who are creating things. Like, you know, we are even defining our disciplines based on that. Like, you know, industrial product designers are designing industrial products. Mm-hmm. User experience designers, digital product designers, we are defining ourselves on what we are creating. But I do believe that it would be kind of time to shift towards an ecocentric design approach, or like an ecosystem type of thinking also, where we are not focusing as much on what is the actual thing that we are creating as a deliverable, but what is the type of change that we can make in an ecosystem, which yeah. can be creating a new product, it can be changing a process, it can be removing an existing product, it can be not doing anything, because yeah. sometimes that is also a designer, the statement of not changing stuff.
Maybe that's the perfect roundup and ending for this episode. Yeah, it was really insightful, I can tell, and a pleasure and also an honor that you found the time
Thank you very much.
To our episode. So thank you as well out there, wonderful people, for listening to our latest episode. And well, if you like what you heard, please give us a subscription, a rating. We would highly appreciate it, and it helps a lot. And so goodbye from my side. Goodbye, Vavo.
Goodbye, everyone. And very excited to meet you all again in the next episode.
Yeah. And since, well, the final words always belong to our guest, Akos, do you have any final words or advice to all of us?
Yeah, and I will have a short one. Hold on. It's been a rough couple of years, and it's going to be a rough couple of years for designers. It's hard to be a designer right now, but just keep believing in what you're doing and hold on.
The Sucks Podcast is brought to you by the Sucks Network, a non-profit initiative and network that drives sustainable and responsible UX based on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Hosted by Thorsten Jonas and me, Bavo Lodwex. Edited by me, Bavo. Support by Isabel Pettinato. We'll see you next time.